the most important thing is to attract great people.
Business continues to grow, more and more people getting it.
Be better prepared than everybody. You've got your best chance.
I think it's a tremendous time to sell your company.
Welcome to the Uncommon Results Show, where we uncover the strategies and tactics to help you and your business grow faster, increase profits, and realize richer exits. Here's your host, Pete Martin.
The show is called Uncommon Results. We really try to focus on extraordinary situations of businesses that either had incredible growth or big exits for, you know, any entrepreneur and business owner. And so we try to distill those down into really valuable lessons for all of us that run companies to improve our own outcomes. So as you look back over the 300 stories you've heard, and maybe you've mentioned a couple here, maybe this Blinds.com was the last one. What are the stories that really stick out to you as just extraordinary? And however you define that in terms of an exit, you know, whether it's price terms, speed, you know, whatever it is, what are the ones that just pop in your brain and go, man, that was a hell of a deal?
Yeah, a couple popped to mind. I did an interview recently with a guy named Rob Walling, who built a company called Drip.com, which is a SaaS-based email marketing software. And I think it's indicative of the danger of chasing revenue and the benefit of focusing on building value. Because about 5 days earlier to my interview with Rob, I did a different interview, a company that had was generating at the time of their sale $15 million. They were a retailer and $15 million of revenue. They sold for about 25% of 1 year's revenue, right? So I go into my interview with Rob Walling and he shares with me that by the time he sold, he had built Drip to $2 million of revenue, right? Like almost one tenth of the retailer. Yeah. And I said, what did you think it was worth? And he said, based on the offers I was receiving and the interest and the marketplace, I thought it was worth between 9 and 13 times revenue.
Revenue. Yep.
And he ended up selling it for a big downstroke, big cash up front, a little earnout that was not tied to earnings. It was tied to the release of a product feature, which he knew he could control because he was a software guy by training. And it just was, it's emblematic to me or illustrative to me of the danger of chasing revenue. You know, like society, we are all, we are socialized, I think, to chase revenue, like the Inc. 5,000, the 5,000 fastest growing companies, right? Ernst & Young Entrepreneur of the Year Award, they throw, the biggest companies are always the ones that are most celebrated, the cover of any magazine or newspaper, et cetera. Yet oftentimes what you don't realize is those companies are not necessarily as valued at companies that are much, much smaller. Equally, the individuals running those companies have given up so much of their equity to build that size that the remaining founders are so diluted that in fact they're not actually creating a lot of wealth. So I think there's that's one of the common themes of stuff we do together at Value Builder but I think that one really pops for me, Rob's exit.
Yeah, it's interesting because you hear the stories about WhatsApp and Instagram, right? Who had these multi-billion dollar exits, I think it was the Instagram story where there's 12 employees and they get acquired by Facebook and they're in the Facebook, auditorium and it's just 12 guys going, what the hell just happened, right? We're only 12 guys, but you don't hear the stories like Drip.com that, are the kind of the non-VC backed, just everyday companies that, to your point, just truly just focused on value and got a reward for that, right? Yeah.
No, it's true. Another one that comes to mind, and it's just top of mind because I just had a conversation with him earlier this week, is Arik Levy. So Arik has built two really successful businesses. They are in the locker space. Whole Foods has their Amazon lockers. Sure. Well, Arik has a business. One was called Laundry Locker, where if you wanted your laundry dropped off, you could get it dropped off in one of his. And the other one is called Luxor One, where they do lockers in Manhattan and other apartment buildings, condominium complexes for people who buy online and want their stuff shipped to a locker. So Laundry Locker is his first exit. And he has a one buyer on the table, and he negotiates with the one buyer. They come up with a letter of intent. He then goes through diligence, and during diligence, that buyer starts to winnow down the value of the business in their eyes, and ultimately makes him another offer in the form of retrading down by about 20%. So now he's taking 20% less. He then finds out that the buyer doesn't have the money to buy his company and has to go borrow the money. And so then they go borrow the money, but they can't borrow it all. So then they've got to get Arik to lend some of the money in a vendor financing deal. So now Arik's taking 20% less and having to finance some of the deal, right? Yeah. So that's his first exit. Compare that to his second exit, where he runs it like a process. Like the map that we talk about in the book. And he goes out, starts with 100 or so acquirers in his like long list, winnows it down, gets five strategics to offer on the business, plays one off the other, goes through another round of diligence, takes it from five down to three. He then does some more diligence, 3 to 2, ultimate plays the last two off of each other. And finally, he gets acquired, agrees to an acquisition offer from a Fortune 500 company called Assa Abloy, their big elevator supplier. And I asked him, what was the difference between, first of all, how much of a difference was there in the first five strategic offers that you got? And he said, you know what? They were almost all the same within, you know, like 10% of one another. Mm-hmm. And then I said, how much through that process of playing one off the other, did you get the offers up from the initial five to the final completion? And he said it was about 3x.
Wow.
In other words, the strategics all came in at about the same.
Yeah.
And through the process of playing one off the other, he was able to triple the value of his company, not 30% more, but triple. And that's the benefit of having competitive tension. And it's probably one of the biggest mistakes that we see owners make, is falling into the hands or arms, I should say, of a proprietary deal, an acquirer where they're just negotiating with one potential acquirer. And it's almost always a recipe for leaving money on the table, as well as retrading, which is what Arik was succumbed to in his first deal. So that one pops to mind because he had the best of times and the worst of times, in one sort of guy.
That's great. And you know, one of the questions I was going to ask you, and you just kind of hit on it, is, you know, what do you see as one of the biggest mistakes that business owners make when they kind of go through this process? And I think you hit on it, that you fall in love with the buyer for whatever reason, right? It's somebody you picked, somebody you've got a relationship with, whatever. And there is no reason for that buyer then to go up their own deal, right? Because there is no competition. There is no alternative for the seller. And if they know that, in particular, if they know that, right, then they hold the leverage. You don't. Any yeah. other kind of common mistakes you see folks make as they kind of go down this process?
Yeah, I mean, that's kind of, if there's one theme to the kind of the book, it's really to try to share some of those lessons learned, those hacks. Another one that comes to mind out of gate is the danger of answering the question, what do you want for your company? I think that question gets folks into trouble from time to time, because on one hand, if you say the price, it can be very difficult to go beyond that, right? The savvy acquirer will say, okay, I know that's your bottom line, but that's now your top line, and you're never going to get anything more than that. Exactly. Equally, if you say something so outlandish, and I know, Pete, in your case, you threw out a big number and it didn't undermine you in your exit, but occasionally, if you throw out too big a number, some acquirers will think, oh man, this guy's totally out to lunch. I can't deal with him. So it can be dangerous, especially if you don't have in your case, you had a great relationship with your acquirer. So in a lot of cases, if you don't enjoy the same degree of relationship, they can walk before you even get a chance to sort of romance them into why. I'm reminded of a story from a guy named Chris Jones that I wrote about. He started a company called Pepper Jam, which was like an affiliate marketing software. And Jones was called by a guy named Michael Rubin. So Rubin sold GSI to PayPal, big, you know, billion-dollar deal, like massive, massive deal. And so Rubin calls up Jones and says, hey, I want you to come down and chat with me about your company. And Jones thinks, oh, this is pretty cool. Michael Rubin's a bit of a luminary in the tech space. So he walks into Rubin's office. And instead of being alone, Rubin is flanked by his chief financial officer and his legal counsel. And without even exchanging hello, Rubin's first line to Jones is, okay, what do you want for Pepper Jam? And Chris is like kind of on his back foot saying like, what are you like, are you kidding me? Like that's your, and Ruben kind of stayed on the offensive. He said, what do you want for your company? And Jones blurted out a number, and I had a chance to interview him. And he said, you know, like if I had it to do over again, I might not have shared that number, because Ruben looked at his lieutenant and said, okay, I think we can get a deal done. Meaning don't buy the company for a penny more than what he just said.
Yeah, for sure.
And on they went. So, I mean, Chris had a great exit and he's gone on to do lots of great stuff. So, you know, we don't need to worry about Chris, but it does indicate to me that the danger of answering that question, and that's one of the most common things that I think acquirers sort of try to get you to answer, that it almost always is a mistake to answer.
So in the book, and this is where I have, my experience has something a little bit different, but you talk about, first of all, knowing your number in advance, right? So you don't get into that situation. You have a lot of really sound advice about if you're asked that question, here's some responses, here's some ways for you to respond, literally giving business owners the words to say to respond to it, right? Which is fantastic. And if it's the first time you go through this process, that's a natural exchange that happens. But one of the things you mentioned is to have a number and in the LOI, pick a number. My personal experience was, and other folks that I've talked to, was that if you've got this growth and profit trajectory and you know it's going to be there, either because of recurring revenues or contracts or whatever, and you know the sales process is going to take a while, 6 to 9 months, right? Why not peg the valuation to a multiple of something, whether it's EBITDA or revenue, preferably revenue, right? Because it's a cleaner thing to measure than EBITDA sometimes. Why not just peg it to a multiple of one of those as opposed to a number, is particularly if you know the process is going to take a while. So that number is going to go up.
Yeah. So the letter of intent that you're describing is a, you know, for folks who've never gone through the process, it's kind of like an engagement ring. It's a, you know, it's where you agree to basic terms with the acquirer, and you also agree generally in a letter of intent to a no shop clause, which basically means that you're not going to continue to negotiate with anybody else. You are going to negotiate exclusively with that one acquirer. And in that scenario, I think it makes sense to fight for a specific number as opposed to a multiple range, because a multiple range gives the acquirer lots of wiggle room. It allows them at times to interpret the document. Oh, well, you know, we didn't have a normalized earnings, or we weren't sure that that was going to happen, or we didn't know the Canadian dollar, the US dollar is going to do. Like there could be thousands of different sort of, areas of interpretation. And when you are weighing one offer against another at an LOI stage, like Arik Levy was doing, it kind of guarantees you, I wouldn't say guarantees is a too strong word, but it assures that the offer you are comparing effectively apples to apples.
Yeah.
In a situation where you're negotiating with one buyer, trust is there's a deep level of trust, and you can agree the definition, certainly something like revenue, which is much less subjective. It's very objective.
Yep.
I think it may make sense in some cases to have a multiple in a letter of intent. But part of running a structured process where you're getting multiple bidders to the table simultaneously and trying to play one off the other is you're trying to use time to your advantage, and right, you're trying to force people to first triangulate around a number and then commit to a 60-day diligence window. And part of forcing that structured process is keeping diligence on track. And so with 60 days, your business is probably unlikely to move that much up or down. So for some of those reasons, I think it makes sense to try to fight for a hard number. It just minimizes all the subjectivity. One of the big mistakes, and we write about it a lot, is this concept of retrading, right? Where a buyer says, look, I'm going to buy your business for, make up a number, $1 million. And they show up 60 days later at the end of diligence and say, we're actually only going to buy it for 800,000 because we found something in diligence. There's illegitimate retrading and legitimate retrading. Illegitimate is when they're using your emotional commitment to a sale against you. Effectively, they're dropping the price because they can. Legitimate retrading is when you miss your numbers during the process. And again, I think if knowing that retrading happens, I think you want to do everything you possibly can to avoid it. Barry Hinckley, I wrote about, he's got something famous called the no retrading handshake. And I said, okay, I'll buy it. What is the no retrading handshake? When I talked to him, and he said, you know what, when you're negotiating with a buyer, you get up when all the terms are agreed to, the price, the earnout, blah, blah, blah. You get up from your chair, you walk around to the person, the most senior person from the other side of the negotiating table, from the acquiring company. And you say, I will do this deal on one condition. Acquirer says, okay, what's the condition? And you say, no retrading. And that's the no retrading handshake. And what you're doing in using it is you're telegraphing to the other side that you are a sophisticated seller, that you know that retrading happens, and that you know that they may try to use your emotional commitment to the sale to lower the price. And that inoculates yourself to a large extent from retrading. Yeah. And so that's just a tactic. So it's a long-winded way of answering. I think using a range can work, but if you're trying to create this competitive tension leading to a very short diligence window, I think locking in a price may also be something to consider.
Yeah, that's fair. Even, and particularly if you're doing a competitive deal, if you're just working with one buyer and that's all, and that is a strategic, and at the end, maybe there's some flexibility to do that, but you do want to be able to compare apples for apples from a deal structure perspective.
Yeah, and I'd also draw a distinction. We do this also in the book, the difference between an IOI and an LOI. IOI being indication of interest, which is very commonly used a multiple of, like a range of multiples, right? Yep. And an IOI is almost a precursor to an LOI. It's a shot over the bow, right? It's like, we're kind of interested in your company. This is the kind of range we're thinking. Whereas an LOI is a much more formal legal document.
Right. Yep. Exactly. And it gets written into the purchase agreement, right? And all the terms that are there. So,
yeah.
So you have an excerpt here in the book, and I'm going to read it real quickly. And I kind of want your kind of counsel on this. So you said, often we start a business for the sense of freedom that we hope it will give us. Early in your company's life cycle, you have all the freedom you want. You can decide how and where you will work. As it grows over time, your business starts to chip away at that freedom, and you can start to feel imprisoned, both financially and psychologically, by what you've created. Not only might you feel trapped by your business, but it might even feel confined by you too. So I love that. It's towards the end of the book, and it just sums up so much about the journey of an entrepreneur and a business owner. And so my question for you is, if a business owner came to you and said, John, I'm that guy. I feel stuck. I feel trapped in my business. What advice would you give that person? Tell me about the conversation you might go through with them.
I'd probably tell him the story of Joey Redner. I mean, Joey, let me tell you the story, and then I'll probably walk you through how I might relay that to them. Joey built Cigar City Brewing. Cigar City is a microbrewery, craft brewery based in Tampa. Joey realized craft brewery beer was growing like leaps and bounds. Sam Adams had created an amazing niche, and he decided to create a craft beer in Tampa. Well, long story short, he borrows $800,000 from his dad, and he builds the first brewing capacity, and he builds this company. And the company's a huge success, right? Like Tampa loves it. He's all the craft beer festivals. It's a huge success. So much so that he runs out of brewing capacity. Still in hock to his dad for $800,000, but he decides to go double down and borrow money from the SBA. So he goes and borrows a few million bucks to build out, expand his brewing capacity. Man, business just continues to grow. More and more people getting it. Now he's exporting the beer all over Florida. So much so that he's run out of brewing capacity. Now he's in hock to his dad and the SBA. And a bank says to him, yeah, sure, we'd be happy to lend you more money to grow this business a third time. Just sign here for the personal guarantee. And Redner explained it to me. He said, you know what? I felt like the poker player, the gambling addict at the table in Vegas with all his chips on the table, having just won a round and out by the skin of my teeth, and now being asked to put all the chips back in and double down. Right. And he said, like, I'd grown a successful business. I'd done everything I wanted to do. And here was the bank asking me to write another personal guarantee to double down again and triple down. And I mean, and he said, enough is enough. And he sold the company And that was the trigger where he sold the company to Oscar Blues, one of the great, you know, craft beer brewer, you know, private equity back. And he couldn't have been happier. He paid back his dad, he paid back the SBA and put a ton of money in his jeans. And he was free at a relatively young age. And so I'd answer that question to go back to your question. There's nothing wrong with letting someone else take a turn at your business. And for most of us as entrepreneurs, we thrive. And I think I'm speaking to the choir here in your case, just given how many businesses you started, we thrive on the new thing, right? The exciting, the challenge, the problems that need, you know, solutions. But when a business reaches a certain threshold, the premium for those attributes starts to diminish and it's replaced by, you know, people who are good at process and people who are good at rigor and consistency and the ability to do the same thing day in, day out with, like, you know, very high levels of consistency. And for most entrepreneurs, that's boring. And so I just think there's nothing, you know, there's nothing wrong with building to a certain threshold, whether that's 1 million in sales, 5 million in sales, it doesn't matter what the number is, and saying, okay, I've done my term, I'm going to move on. And if you feel trapped, I mean, I see this all the time. I see people get comfortable in their business where they're satisfied with their business, but they're not necessarily happy with it anymore.
Yeah.
I can think of a couple of examples in my personal life among my friend group of guys and gals who are in their 50s who have built businesses that at one point grew quite quickly and are now kind of plateauing. They're just throwing off a lot of cash and the owner has become comfortable with that cash. But I'm not sure if I asked them after a couple glasses of wine in a quiet corner if they still enjoyed the business quite as much. And so I think, man, in those circumstances, especially to take our conversation full circle in the environment we're in now with interest rates being so low, I don't know if I wouldn't say, look, you know, you never know what's around the corner. It may be the right time to get out. So
I think there's always a danger when you get too comfortable and the business is running and you're not fully engaged anymore, right? When typically speaking, when you're fully engaged in anything and that with that focus, right, you get better results. And I've seen the same thing with my friend groups. They entrepreneurs will get comfortable with the business. They'll start to pull back. And, you know, Dan Sullivan, a lot of coaches will say, you know, just run your business one day a week. But I think there's a danger there that the business will start to do this and you won't see it, right? Because it just happens gradually. And then by the time you wake up and you start to get a re-engage, you're like, crap, what just happened? Like, everything's a mess, right? And so I do think there's this really dangerous period of being able to pull back, detract, feel not trapped, you know, and kind of get to that comfortable position. And then all of a sudden, whether it's external events that force something or you just stop focusing on the business, that the business declines and now you've got a depreciating asset, right? So,
yeah. As soon as you reach that point of cresting the wave, you know, you're lopping massive amounts of value off your company. As long as you can tell that story that you're on a growth trajectory, that your days ahead are better than the days before, that's going to be an attractive business. But as soon as you start to say, yeah, we sort of crested here, we plateaued for a couple of years, and I think it's now time for me to get out, that's going to be a much, much different valuation conversation than if you can make the case you're growing. And the other thing is, again, you did such an amazing job with your exit, but for most entrepreneurs, in particular service company owners, they are going to have to do an earnout, right? Where there is the average in the US is 3 years, as long as 7 years, I've heard. Wow. So if you're waiting until your business crests and plateaus to sell, you're going to go through your earnout at a period where your business is basically stalled and probably in decline. And it's very difficult to achieve the goals. And they're often stacked. You know, another guy I interviewed for the books guy named Rod Drury, who started Xero, which is the cloud-based accounting platform, right? The big Coke Pepsi battle, like with QuickBooks right now. So he got the money to start Xero by creating a company called Aftermail. And after Mails sold, the headline number in Rod's hometown of Wellington, New Zealand was $35 million. So huge exit. The guy, he was young at the time. So I mean, it's just like a spectacular exit. What that headline number did not reveal, however, was that the downstroke, in other words, the cash payment up front, was $15 million with an extra 20 in an earnout. Earnout being, you know, a tranche of cash that you've got to, you'll get if you achieve certain goals in the future. Well, jury, what, I mean, what does the young guy do when he gets $15 million? He kind of enjoys himself and takes his foot off the gas. And, you know, he kind of pulls up after a little bit of reflection time and starts to go to work trying to hit his earnout. But by that time, it was very difficult because the way earnouts are usually structured is there are gates you've got to hit along the way to release budget. And he missed his first gate. And like a downhill ski racer, you miss your first gate. There's no way you're going to catch up, right? It's done. And so he missed his first gate and left kind of 9 months later. Now, I mean, he went on to have tremendous success with zero. So it's not like he's sort of like wallowing in his beer, but it's just an indication that with an earnout, first of all, it's always at risk. Almost always at risk, I should say. And number two, it's something you want to go into with tremendous energy, enthusiasm, when you're really excited about the future, as opposed to when you're like, oh my God, get me out of here. Because at that point, it's going to be almost impossible.
Yeah, for sure. All right, final question. This has been, God, so enlightening for me, and I think for all of our listeners. So my last question for you is, if someone came to you and said, John, I'm thinking of selling my business, what would you tell them to do? Step one, step two, step three. Not necessarily knowing anything really about their situation, whether they're pulling or kind of pushing against from a motivation perspective.
Yeah, I want to know why they want to sell. So that does the reason I'd want to know that is like, what are you going to go do? What are you going to do with the money? What are you going to do with your time? What's driving the decision? And so that's probably the first. Spend a little bit of time on that piece. And get clarity around that. I think the next step, and again, we're kind of getting into some of the things that we talk about in the book, but this idea of coming up with a strategic rationale to buy your company. What is it that you have that nobody else has? In the case of Jay Steinfeld and Home Depot and the acquisition of Blinds.com, what Jay had figured out is how to sell a complicated hardware product, in his case, blinds, online. Because blinds are difficult, right? You got to measure them, you got to install them, customize. It's very complicated. And Home Depot had a problem. At the time, they were a $90 billion company, yet virtually no sales through their website, right? Everything was sold through the store. And they wanted to figure out, how do we get better at selling online, especially complicated products online that people want to touch and feel? And they knew, they'd done the math to know that if people bought on HomeDepot.com, it was wildly more profitable than if they had to, you know, send them into a school. And so in part, Home Depot bought Blinds.com because they wanted the blinds category. They wanted to be number one in blinds. But the second part, again, sort of a hidden reason, is that they wanted to get better and learn his best practices and secrets for selling complicated products, because they could use that across $90 billion worth of revenue. And that was the strategic rationale, the investment thesis, as M&A guys like to talk about. And so I think the second step would be to try to figure out, what's the investment thesis? Like, why would someone want to buy this company, right? And who are the people that would feel that investment thesis most strongly, be most passionately about that investment thesis? Another example from the book, Stephanie Breedlove built a payroll company, $9 million in revenue, 10,000 customers. They do payroll for parents who had a nanny to pay. So roll back 20 years when you had young kids, you and your spouse working, need a nanny. Gosh, it's hard to pay them, right? If you don't want to pay them cash, it's really hard. So you hire Breedlove's company and they do payroll for nannies. Well, Care.com was created to help you find a nanny, right? Yep. Plug in your zip code and it'll give you the 5-star. So Breedlove goes to Care and says, you've got 7 million subscribers and I've got just 10,000 customers. If 1% of the 7 million subscribers of Care.com bought my payroll service, that would be a company 7 times the size of my business. Long story short, Care.com acquired Breedlove's $9 million business for $54 million.
That's a hell of a valuation.
It's a health evaluation.
That's somebody who got the narrative right.
Yeah, it's the narrative, it's the story, it's the art, and it's the investment thesis, right? So I think the second step is like, what's the thesis here? Like, why would someone want to buy your company? And then I think the third is probably coming up with a list, right? Really being thoughtful about who are the most natural acquirers for your company, both strategics, Home Depot, Care.com, in the case of the two examples I just shared, but also private equity groups, because even though you may not want to sell to a private equity group, they can be a tremendous offer that you can use to play off the other folks at the table.
Yeah, awesome. The book is called The Art of Selling Your Business, Winning Strategies and Secret Hacks for Exiting at the Top. John, what's the best place to get the book, would you say?
I mean, anywhere you buy books, Amazon is probably these days deep in the throes of a pandemic, the one everybody's most familiar with. So probably Amazon is best.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much for the time. I appreciate it. This has just been incredibly educational, informative, and fun. And I wish you the best with Value Builders. And let's keep helping out as many people as we possibly can.
Thanks, Pete. Appreciate
it. Thanks, John. Have a good one.
Thanks for listening to the Uncommon Results Show. Be sure to click below to subscribe to the show for more lessons on how to grow, scale, and sell your business. Until then, here's to your growth.